like catching in this system. It's nice.
Good evening, everybody.
Good evening.
Good to see you again. 2 weeks ago, we began a five-part series on rediscovering the ancient ways of Christianity. And, of course, both parts one and two online already. First week was the need for real community, loneliness, life transitions, and feasting. We addressed several themes with loneliness and Christianity directly challenging all those themes. And then we talked that week about the sacramental worldview that we have in our faith, including the tools we have for reconciling with each other, such as confession and forgetting the Sunday and forgiveness, and also tools for managing life transitions, such as the different feasts, such as baptism and growing up and aging and even death, which has its rites that carry us through. Last week, we reflected with Alain de Botton on how authentic religion fosters real goodness and kindness in people when it's practiced authentically, as opposed to badly. Or rather, when it's practiced traditionally, as opposed to kind of in a watered-down form, you know. So one of my favorite image in that last week was the image of the star chart, you know, like kids. What motivates children is the star chart. You know, here are some things. It isn't usually the hard power of parenting, like do this or, you know, or I'm going to spank you. It's rather the kind of occasional nudge from punishment, but also the gentler approach of these little rewards to celebrate and encourage children. And religion, he noted, offers some tools like, you know, encouraging us to be slow to anger, encouraging us to forgive, encouraging us to imagine how someone else would feel, to imagine living in their shoes, do unto others as they have them, as you have them do unto you. Religions help us to put our own struggles in perspective so that we're not feeling that we're lost in the middle of nowhere because, well, people have done this before. They've struggled with these same things. Authentic faith opens us up to cliched advice we talked about, right? Because cliches aren't bad. And sometimes we need to hear it over and over again. We'll talk more about that tonight. We also talked about the value of role models, right? Saints and ascetical figures and nuns and monks. And I'm reading a book right now, which I just got. It was given to me at the monastery last week. It's called Everyday Saints. Have you guys ever heard of it before?
No.
In Russian, it's Nesvyatiya Svyatiya, which means unsainted or unholy saints. And it's really fun. Because you get a set, these are people who lived, some of them are still alive, but they've all lived in the last half century, and people in Russia, and it's about their lives, and sometimes it's kind of messy. And that's part of the beauty of it, because even when the lives aren't ideal, you still are given these images of things that are good and bad, and people who have problems, who struggle through them. And so this is part of our church life, is always having these kind of things, the good, the bad, the ugly before us, to help gauge and help us orient our lives in a way that's constructive and truly Christian. So, looking to what we're getting to tonight, there's a quote Alain de Botton has at the beginning of this chapter we're looking at tonight. He says, there are few things that secular society believes more fervently in than education. Since the Enlightenment, education, that is from a primary level through university, has been presented as the most effective answer to the range of society's greatest ills. It is the conduit to fashioning a civilized, prosperous, and rational citizenry. You know, if you look at the college view books, you know, the first thing you see is, well, you realize pretty quickly that more than half of the courses offered, half of the degrees offered, are very kind of technical now. Mm-hmm. You know, it's nursing, it's law school, it's environmental engineering, it's forestry, very kind of hands-on kind of things. The problem isn't that colleges turn out professionals who have these very strong skills, but what's really interesting is the claim that the university teaches you how to think. That's sort of the big thing, right? That's what drew people to the colleges a lot. You go to school to learn how to really think. So I want to quote two paragraphs here from him. He says this in page 102, the grander claim is made on behalf of education, the sort one reads of in a prospectus or hears about in graduation ceremonies, tend to imply that colleges and universities are more than mere factories for turning out technocrats and industrialists. The suggestion is that they have yet a higher task to fulfill that may turn us into better, wiser, and of course, happier people. As John Stuart Mill, another Victorian defender of the aims of education, put it, quote, "The object of universities is not to make skillful lawyers, physicians, or engineers, it is to make capable and cultivated human beings." Or to go back to another thinker, "A proper cultural education should inspire in us a love of our neighbor, a desire for clearing human confusion, and for diminishing human misery." End quote. At its most ambitious, it should engender nothing less than the noble aspiration to leave the world better and happier than we found it. Now, this all sounds great, but the problem is to make capable and cultivated people is rather vague, you know. And that's what Debaton points to here. So the idea that he's putting, that's put out there is immerse yourself in an obscure field for a couple of years and that will transform you. Well, maybe not. And I mentioned the church earlier, you know, when I was at college, when I was at University of Florida, I did a 3-2 program where you did your undergraduate degree, and then you did a couple of years of graduate study, and they gave you a master's degree. I had someone who was doing like the 17th century sexual practices of Tutsi people in Uganda. That was like one of them. It was something like that. Yeah. And then like another one he mentioned was like crop yields in 1743 France, you know, looking at just some of these bizarre things that have no, like, what do you do with that? Yeah. What's the meaning there?
Right.
And so it's a challenge, and it's something that really troubles him as an atheist. You know, what do you do with all this stuff? And it troubles me as a Christian. He writes this: "The application of a university's academics to their tasks is intense and moving. They try really hard. And yet it is hard to see how the content of their courses and the direction of their examination bear any significant relationship to the vision that was articulated before about making better humans. Whatever rhetoric may be rehearsed in the prospectuses, the modern university appears to have precious little interest in teaching its students any emotional or ethical life skills, much less how to love their neighbor and leave the world a happier place than they found it. The prerequisites for a BA in philosophy, for instance, are limited to a familiarity with central topics of metaphysics and the completion of a thesis on concepts of intentionality in different philosophical schools. An equivalent degree in English literature will be awarded to those who can successfully tackle the wasteland on allegorical and anagogical levels and trace the influence of Seneca's dramatic theories on the development of Jacobean theater. Graduation speeches stereotypically identify liberal education with the acquisition of wisdom and self-knowledge, but these goals have little bearing on the day-to-day methods of departmental instruction and examination. To judge by what they do rather than what they airily proclaim, universities are in the business of turning out a majority of tightly focused professionals, lawyers, engineers, physicians, and a minority of culturally well-informed but ethically confused art graduates who aptly panic about how they might inevitably spend the rest of their lives earning money." Does it sound familiar to many of us?
Yes.
I'm a history major, you know?
You just have to take the word art with philosophy. That's also pretty good.
What's your major,
confusing.
Audrey?
It was philosophy.
Philosophy?
English.
Music.
History. That's four of us here. So, you know, this is
that. Just have useful skills.
So, and he concludes here, "We have implicitly charged our higher education system with a dual and possibly contradictory mission to teach us how to make a living and to teach us how to live. And we have left the second of these two aims recklessly vague and unattended." I like the way he writes. I think he's funny.
Yeah.
So, you know, this is the challenge here. And, you know, one of the most fascinating arguments that he makes here in the pages that follow is the contention that, in a sense, the world needs Scripture. Now, he doesn't mean they need the Bible, you know, necessarily. What he's saying is that the Bible played a role in culture that grounded everything else. It was the kind of foundation for even investigating philosophy, the foundation for the sciences, you know. It was the foundation for human emotional health, human reflection, etc. So I want to read a couple paragraphs here about this. When religious belief began to fracture in Europe in the early 19th century, anguished questions were raised about how, in the absence of a Christian framework, people would manage to find meaning, understand themselves, behave in a moral fashion, forgive their fellow humans, and confront their own mortality. In answer, it was proposed by an influential faction that cultural works be henceforth consulted in place of the biblical texts. Culture could replace scripture. The hope was that culture might be no less effective than religion, by which you mean Christianity in this case, in its ability to guide, humanize, and console us. Histories, paintings, philosophies, fictional narratives could all be mined to yield lessons not far removed in their ethical tenor and emotional impact from those taught by the Bible. One would be able to have meaning unburdened by superstition. The maxims of Marcus Aurelius, the poetry of Boccaccio, the operas of Wagner, and the paintings of Turner could be secular society's new sacraments. On the basis of such notions, whole subject areas which had never been included in formal education began to enter the curricula of universities in Europe and America. Literature, previously dismissed as being worthy of study only by adolescent girls and those convalescing, was recognized as a series subject fit for analysis within Western universities during the second half of the 19th century. The newfound prestige of novels and poems was based on the realization these forms, much like the Gospels, could deliver complex moral messages embedded within emotionally charged narratives and thereby prompt effective identification and self-examination. In his inaugural lecture to Oxford in 1922, George Gordon, the Merton Professor of Literature, emphasized the scale of the task that had fallen to his field. Quote, "England is sick, and English literature must save it. The churches, as I understand them, having failed, and social remedies being slow, English literature now has the triple function, still, I suppose, to delight us and instruct us, but also, and above all, to save our souls and heal our state." Mm-hmm. It's a huge shift he's talking about.
That was Richard Wagner's whole shtick.
His
operas were supposed to be this kind of reinterpretation of the human narrative, and to get this kind of scriptural meta-narrative, you can place yourself into the Ring Cycle, or you can place yourself into Tristan and Isolde, and derive meaningful life lessons from that. And it's interesting because my field, musicology, didn't emerge until 1875, 1880, in Germany, in response to this critical apprehension of works of music as being quote-unquote sacred texts.
Right. And even certain writers in church life, you know, certain of the Silver Age Russian composers, mm-hmm. and certainly Silver Age Russian literature, well, you know, that'd be Golden Age, actually. They are romantics who are trying to create a corpus of literature that is the base of their culture.
Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting. I have it in my notes here later, but I'll say it now. Well, no, I'll say it's right here. Literature and artful of meaning. And what's interesting about, so I know Russian culture, Russian literature the best. You know the musicology end of things, mm-hmm. Nate. But, you know, Russian literature is full of heroic scenes and art and music. You go to the Russian Museum, you have these incredible works of art that are almost, they're epic. They're epic works of art. And they're biblical, and a lot of them are biblical. But I mean, they're biblical in their range and kind of universalism. Human themes of loss and redemption in Dostoevsky and Tolstoy. Philosophy and Turgenev, nihilism's introduced, and all these things. Well, what's interesting in Russia is for people who were believers, many of them had as their scripture, because you couldn't get the Bible. The scripture for them was the Russian classics. Like Solzhenitsyn, his faith was kept. He didn't know the Bible. I mean, he eventually did, but when he was a young man, he did not, but he knew the Russian classics, which in turn were steeped in the Bible, by the way. But the canon for these people was essentially what was the Russian classics, which frankly wasn't bad.
Right.
But the point, you know, it had a function like scripture almost.
Mm-hmm.
But the problem with using literature as your canon is stated pretty clearly here by Alain de Botton. Paragraph. We are by no means lacking in material, which we might call into service to replace holy texts. We are simply treating that material in the wrong way. We are unwilling to consider secular culture religiously, in other words, as a source of guidance. So opposed have many atheists been to the content of religious belief that they have omitted to appreciate its inspiring and still valid objective, to provide us with well-structured advice on how to lead our lives. Now, of course, for us, it doesn't work, right? Because we're not looking for advice, we're looking for truth. But what he's saying here is the problem with sort of using culture and literature as your guide is people don't really agree, this is binding for me. This, I must live my life by Turgenev. Or by no one says that, right? I wouldn't say that. I like Turgenev. I like Dostoevsky, but imagine saying I'm going to live by this code, the way a Chinese person would live by the code of Confucius, you know, which has its literature, but it also has this kind of ethical obligation attached to it. Or being Orthodox, we live by the ethos of the scriptures, or by the fathers and the mothers of the church, and we try to live our lives somewhere in that matrix they set out there for us. So, but Christianity offers a very different approach. You know, last week we spoke about original sin. And in Christianity teaches, in light of that doctrine, that we are wondrous yet fallible creatures, desperately in need of reconnection, that is religion, so to speak, because religion means to connect, right? Connection to our Creator, that we are. We are a little broken, we're vulnerable, we have more knowledge than wisdom, and we have more information. You know, we can Google things, we can know things, but it doesn't make us wise, right? We're anxious, we're tortured by relationships sometimes, we're afraid of death. In short, we're in need of God. So what sort of education might benefit us? That's sort of the question of religion. You know, what kind of education would really and truly help us? So I want to read this here. We're familiar enough with the major categories of humanities as they are taught in the universities, history, anthropology, literature, philosophy, as well as with the sorts of examination that they produce. Who were the Carolingians? Where did phenomenology originate? What did Emerson want? We know, too, that this scheme leaves the emotional aspects of our characters developed spontaneously, or at least very much in private. Perhaps when we are with our families or on solitary walks in the countryside. In contrast, Christianity concerns itself from the outset with the inner confused side of us, declaring that we are none of us born knowing how to live. We are by nature fragile and capricious, unempathetic and beset by fantasies of omnipotence, worlds away from being able to command even a modicum of the good sense and calm that secular education takes as a starting point for its own pedagogy. He's saying Christianity is a little honest about human weaknesses. Mm-hmm. Which I think is very important. Mm-hmm. Christianity is focused on helping a part of us that secular language cannot even name, which is not precisely intelligence or emotion, not character or personality, but another, even more abstract entity, loosely connected with all of those, yet differentiated from them by an additional ethical and transcendent dimension, to which we may as well refer, following the Christian term, the soul. It has been the essential task of the Christian pedagogic machine to nurture, reassure, comfort, and guide souls. So this is a very interesting word, you know. Maybe psychologically, the universe would speak of the soul, but in terms of a spiritual entity, it's not really part of the lexicon, I don't think, is it?
Lexicon of...
Of education. We don't. You don't hear talk about the soul very much.
No.
Other than I would say not at all. No.
Okay.
Like, or this, you know, not the spirit or whatever.
So, you know, that's sort of a generalization, but Christianity, the whole focus of it is on the soul, which is integrative, right? Integrating the body, integrating the needs of this soul or spirit that has ethical and transcendental dimensions to it. But of course, if you don't believe in a transcendental dimension, then how can you even speak of it, right? But he's saying the Christians get this. And this is very important. So, and of course, then, if this is true, if Christians really deal with questions of the soul, the way to get to the soul is by dealing with real, tangible, you know, how do you live your life? How do we negotiate relationships, problems? You know, so Christianity should speak to these things. And Elaine de Botton says this, Christianity cares about questions like how can we live together? How can we tolerate other people's faults? How can we accept our own limitations and assuage our anger? A degree of urgent didacticism is a requirement rather than an insult. The difference between Christian and secular education reveals itself with particular clarity in the respective characteristic modes of instruction. Secular education delivers lectures. Christianity gives sermons. Expressed in terms of intent, we might say that one is concerned with imparting information, the other with changing our life. Sermons, by their very nature, assume that their audiences are in important ways lost. The title alone of the sermons by one of the most famous preachers of all time, John Wesley, show Christianity seeking to dispense practical advice about a range of the soul's challenges. On being kind, on staying obedient to parents, on visiting the sick, on caution against bigotry. These are examples of the sermons. Unlikely though it seems that Wesley's sermons could ever seduce atheists through their content, they nevertheless succeed, like any number of Christian texts, in categorizing knowledge under very useful headings. And this is important, you know, it's very a very practical thing. You know, Christianity, you know, the way it kind of teaches us is much like Aesop's fables. Think about Jesus, and you know, he offers parables. Mm-hmm. Aesop offered fables that were full of value and good sense. And whereas atheists are kind of, as de Botton says, fatefully in love with ambiguity, and the modernist doctrine that great art should have absolutely no moral content or intention, intention of changing the audience's view, if that's true for atheism and modern secularism, it's true that Christianity has the opposite intention. It's to impact our life, to make us more in the image of God, you know, through our actions and our words and our thoughts. So authentic religion then connects kind of a childlike part of our hearts to basic teachings. You know, think about a child. My son, when he is misbehaving, the best thing I can do for him is to lay out for him clearly, this is the boundary, son. This is what you must do, this is what you can't do. What is the expectation? And it's very simple and very basic, like the Ten Commandments, right? Like Jesus is teaching, you know, love God with all your heart and your neighbor as yourself. You know, if you want to be saved, become like a little child. You know, be wise as a serpent, innocent as a dove. These are very kind of, it's not rocket science, you know, it's very simple. And yet, the greatest Christian preachers, de Botton notes, were, he used the phrase, unabashedly vulgar, you know, common, mm-hmm. in the way they approached teaching the faith. Not that they were simple in a bad way, but they were very direct. And they had the precise goal of helping people live their lives and finding a place of peace. There's inherent value laden in that. And that's something he said is totally missing in the secular world. And I agree. So another kind of focus he has here that I appreciate was the emphasis on how education is imparted. So, you know, how is as important as what, I think. The Russians have a proverb that's one of my very favorites. It's povtorenie mat uchenia. Repetition is the mother of. It's a good one. And with that in mind, I want to read a passage from de Botton about how we're taught. In its methods, Christianity has from the very beginning been guided by a simple set of principles that has never made a big impression upon the secular education. This emphasis is how easily we forget things, right? We are very forgetful. Christian theologians have known that our soul suffers from what ancient Greeks called akrasia, a perplexing tendency to know what we should do combined with a persistent reluctance to actually do it, whether through weakness of will or absent-mindedness. We all possess wisdom that we lack, but we lack the strength to properly enact it in our lives. Isn't this true? Like, when you're baptized, you know, we heard all this great stuff, you know? And we hear it every Sunday. We know Pascha, but we forget it routinely. And the church understands this, which is why we have Lent every year. which is why we have the cycles of the feasts. It's why we have the cycles of the readings. It's why we have to face some of the same stuff again. It's why I can read something 1 year and see something profound and be feel transformed. And the next year I come back to it again and I see something different, but it takes me in a little different direction. Mm-hmm. But I'm seeing it from a different side. But it's the same stuff year in and year out that we're being urged to look at. And what's great about Orthodoxy, by the way, is because we have... So the Bible and the Gospel, especially, is the center of our liturgical life. But we have hundreds of commentaries. I mean, literally, in some cases, different fathers and writers on that same Gospel. So we can revisit that Gospel in its essence, but then look at it from a hundred different ways. So we never can exhaust the possibility there. Mm-hmm. But we're still having to interact with these same basic themes year in and year out. Christianity pictures the human mind as a sluggish and fickle organ, easy enough to impress, but forever inclined to change its focus and cast its commitments aside. Consequently, the religion proposes that the central issue for education is not so much how to counteract ignorance, as secular educators imply, as how we can combat our reluctance to act upon our ideas that we've already fully understood at a theoretical level and already accept. How do we revisit those ideas? How do we really begin to live those ideas? This is a main focus in Christianity. And so repetition is hugely important. The defenders of the secular university have seldom worried about accuracy, about this forgetfulness, about this failure to internalize what we're learning with our minds. They implicitly maintain that people will be properly affected by concepts even when they hear about them only once or twice. At the age of 20, before a 50-year career in finance or market research, via lecturer standing in the bare room speaking in a monotone. According to this view, ideas may fall out of the mind in such much the same random order as the contents of an upturned handbag. It may be expressed with all the gracious banality of an instruction manual without threatening the overall purpose of intellectual endeavor. What he's saying here is, you know, golly, we listen to stuff in a lecture hall once, and there's the thought that, well, it'll stick with us. Right. Like, that's ludicrous. That's insane. And I think good modern educational theory actually would recognize that that's just, I mean, common sense would say that's silly. Mm-hmm. But we still do it. Think about our classes in college. You know, the lecture hall isn't the best way to learn things, unless you want to just get a kind of broad, you know, broad survey that kind of can guide further study, which is important too. And I suppose it's how they justify the way they do things. But in contrast, well, he says this, you know, in Christianity, there's an attempt to embed teaching in beauty, in music, in poetry, in hymnography, in repetition, and of course the kind of apex that would be the divine liturgy, the services, we get a lot of that, but also in different forms of reading, you know, different forms of art in the church music, etc. And he points out that certain religious traditions do this in different ways. One would be, you know, here's this woman singing hymns in the Pentecostal church. She's a, you know, black woman singing. And the quote at the bottom, the subscript would be, could a lecture on Walt Whitman be this movie? You know, the answer is no, you know, because, you know, she's pondering some themes that might be Whitman-esque, but she's incorporating her body and her voice and all these other things in her learning about God. And in Orthodoxy, of course, we do this as well. Repetition is huge. And I want to go ahead and jump to the next point here, because I think it connects indirectly. One of the first things I noticed about Orthodoxy when I encountered the Orthodox faith was, my buddy had a prayer corner. He had the space to pray. I went to church and I saw prostrations and crossing. He talked about fasting. Because I asked, I'm like, why are you eating all this awful food? He was in college. He didn't know how to cook, you know. Mm-hmm. He was eating stuff that, really rough stuff, you know. Like, what are you doing, dude? I'm fasting. I'm like, what is that about? He just pulls out his church calendar. So you've got fasting and church calendars, you have retreats and you have reflection, all this stuff. And And but all these things serve to embed and incarnate what we're learning. You know, what we're because our learning is not just our head; it's about our whole soul, right? It's our mind, our heart, our body in union. And that was my first impression about Orthodoxy. It was about bringing all these things together to experience God and not have this akrasia, right? We're forgetting all the time, not being mindful of God. So Debutant has a couple of pages here that are really beautiful on this. And funny, too. Religions understand the value of training our minds with a rigor that we are accustomed to applying only to the training of our bodies. They present us with an array of spiritual exercises designed to strengthen our inclination towards virtuous thought and patterns of behavior. They sit us down in unfamiliar spaces. They adjust our posture, the regular that we eat. They give us scripts detailing what we should say to each other. And minutely monitor the thoughts that cross our consciousness. They do all of this not in order to deny our freedom, but to quell our anxieties and flex our moral capacities. Isn't that great? Isn't that an insight? They do this not to deny us freedom, but to quell our anxieties, kind of bring our temperature down, and then guide us toward a better moral vision, a better life, you might say, more in touch with ourselves, with God, with each other. This double insight, that we should train our minds just as we train our bodies, and that we should do so partly through the body, has led to the founding by all the major faiths, I would say by all major traditional faiths, of religious retreats where adherents may, for a limited time, abscond from their ordinary lives and find inner restoration through spiritual exercise. The secular world offers no parallels. Our closest equivalents are country hotels and spas, though the comparison serves only to reveal the shallowness of these things. The brochures for such establishments tend to promise us opportunities to rediscover what is most essential to us. They show us images of couples in plush dressing gowns. They vaunt the quality of the mattresses and toiletries, or boast the 24-hour provision of room service. But the emphasis is always on physical satiation and mental diversion, rather than any real fulfillment of the needs of our soul. These places have no way of helping us when the incompatibilities of our relations reach a new nadir. When reading the Sunday newspapers provoke panic about our careers or our life, we wake up in terror just before dawn, paralyzed by the thought of how short the span of life remains to us. Otherwise, solicitous concierges, brimfuls of ideas about where we might partake of horse riding or mini golf, all this will fall silently, suddenly silent when questioned about the strategies for coping with guilt, or wayward longing, or self-hate. And all these things offer us nothing. Vacation by itself offers us nothing. Not that vacation is bad. Vacation, I think, is great. But his point is, if that's all we have, and that doesn't solve our problem. It doesn't help us deal with these anxieties and these fears and all the stuff that human beings who are honest with themselves are going to struggle with, right? He goes on to describe a retreat that he took at a Buddhist monastery. And the centerpiece of this experience, he reports, is the attempt that was kind of suggested to him to turn off the ego, to let the body be at peace. And, you know, ironically, in Orthodoxy, we have the same kind of struggle, right? To part of a serious discipline prayer life is to learn to kind of turn off the voice in our head. It's always the thing. Do this. You're hungry now. Oh, you have this thought now. Oh, the kind of chatter of our mind. Turn that off and to let stillness reign instead of the chatter of our mind. And the spiritual tools that lead us to that is things like the Jesus Prayer. Things like, you know, standing and prostrating ourselves. Maybe even combine that with a retreat to a monastery. Or a retreat for the day where you go hiking and you go pray. I mean, you know, all of this exists and is celebrated in our tradition as Orthodox Christians. So there's one final paragraph here I want to share. The specifics of the exercises taught, in this case, at the Buddhist monastery, but in other retreats, are perhaps not as significant the general point they raise about our need to impose greater discipline in all of our lives. If the predominant share of our distress is caused by the state of our psyches, It seems perverse that the modern leisure industry should always seek to bring comfort to our bodies without attempting simultaneously to console and tame what the Buddhists would presciently term our monkey minds. We require effective centers for the restoration of our whole beings, retreats devoted to educating, not just with our mind, but through an array of spiritual exercises, our physical as well as spiritual selves. You know, the two go hand in hand, and he's trying to tell his, you know, his atheist friends, guys, wake up and see this, this truth. And what I love is we have all this stuff in front of us if we're able to sort of enter into it. That's the challenge I think we have as other Christians to say, wow, you know, we have this great heritage, this great inheritance. You know, if there's a traditional faith, this is it. Within Christianity, this is as traditional as any Buddhism I can think of, you know, in the Eastern religions. So, I won't read anymore. A couple of the paragraphs that were good. But I think next week we're going to be looking at the human needs that are so incarnated in religion. Tenderness, perspective, bless you, art, and meaning. So we'll talk a lot about, particularly about art and music next week. Those things role in addressing the needs of the human person. We all have needs spiritually. How does our faith address that? How does our faith speak to us about those things? So God bless you this week, and I look forward to that next week. And then we have Thanksgiving, and then we have the final week. We'll talk about institutions. What are they? Because that's a popular, people just hate talking about.
I know, like, one of my biggest pet peeves is people, religion mean relationship or something like that?